And here's one of the experts from the University of Washington School of Public Health, Amy Hagopian, who's been working, teaching, mentoring, researching in the area of health workforce, planning, development, distribution, all those kinds of good things. Lead on, you've got a special
Thank
program.
Thank you, Tom. Yes, I'm trying a new program called Prezi. Has anyone here ever used it? Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Good for you. So I had a student teach me this, so I could do this. And a slightly different title than I think what was advertised. I want to talk about why the assault on public higher education in America is bad for global health generally. Okay. My disclosures are that I do work for a public university, and I am invested in the future. These are the graduates of University of California, Santa Cruz. My niece was in that class in June. And I want to say that I think few would argue that the one thing America does better than anybody else is higher education. There may be one exception to that, which would be Hollywood. We might do Hollywood better than anybody else. But I would say we've had the best higher education system in the world since World War II. And we are in danger of destroying it with the budget cuts and the austerity and the privatization that's underway now. My students from last year, and I'm going to talk today about why higher education and global health both face serious threats, and those of us who care about both should see our futures as intertwined. So why are universities best positioned to be the implementers of global health initiatives and policies? I'm going to describe 17 reasons. Some of these ideally are, a bit idealized. That is, they are aspirational more than actual in some cases, but bear with me here. So these are a couple of students. On the left is a medical student from the University of Washington. On the right is a medical student from Makerere University in Uganda. And I brought these two students together with another team to do a research project last summer. And I would argue that universities are not for profit, not for ideology, not for politics, and not for self-aggrandizement, at least in an ideal world, and therefore they are well-suited to be global health implementers. Universities are enduring. They're not formed in response to grant opportunities, unlike many NGOs. And universities are evidence-driven, again, ideally. I'd say universities are accountable to the public, certainly public universities, but I think even nonprofit private universities are accountable. Universities are maneuverable. This is our team in Uganda collecting data from 300 health facilities around the country, and they overcame every obstacle in their way. Principal investigators are a unique feature of how public universities, private universities work with funders and donors, and these are people who work hard, are willing to travel and network well. Universities involve eager and smart students. Universities are active in associations. This is a meeting at APHA last year where we brought our colleagues from Namibia. These are some colleagues I worked with on a project in Iraq, and I would say universities can draw on deep multidisciplinary talent pools. These are some students and faculty leading a protest around health workforce working conditions in Uganda, and this is to illustrate that I think universities can take risks because of academic freedom. Universities also have obvious counterpart organizations in other countries, that is, other universities, and they enjoy working in exchanges and partnerships. Universities can ally with government easily, and in the case of public universities, we are government. Collaborations are conducted without concern for proprietary knowledge hoarding. I've worked with several non-government organizations, even nonprofit ones, that are very possessive of the knowledge they have and not willing to share. Universities reward publishing, case in point. Okay, And I think another important feature of universities in global health is that they focus on the root causes of health problems and can focus on basic solutions, such as training human resources for health and poverty reduction. And as illustrated by this protest in front of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation in my home community, universities can take risks like this, challenging the received wisdom from the major power brokers in the field. And we care about social justice and advocacy, and we can demonstrate best practices for access and quality. So that's sort of my premise here. And now I want to talk about the threats to global health. The Millennium Development Goals were a pledge of solidarity on the part of the international community towards the poor and poor countries. So let's talk about the emerging threats to the pledges we've made as a planet to improve global health. And I would argue, just to show what this picture is, that war, militarism, and the ubiquitous drone attacks are one such threat to global health. And I think it's a threat we don't normally acknowledge as a threat. For example, it's not listed in the competencies to deal with war as a threat to global health internationally, which arguably is a threat that is much bigger than many diseases combined. So this American drone is an American weapon that is an increasing threat to peace and public health in the world. I think the focus on single diseases as opposed to systems has been a threat to global health, and we're just starting to pull out of that myopic view. Society's underlying wealth maldistribution is clearly a threat to global health in both in rich and in poor countries. The global economic crisis is a major threat to global health, and it's fueled poverty and rising food prices. And while the government is responsible for the equitable distribution of health services, PEPFAR and other donors have preferred to invest in the private sector, and investments in the public and government sector are on the decline. And finally, the World Health Organization is in a financial crisis, and I think that is a threat to global health, given the transfer of the power base from international collectively accountable organizations like WHO to private donor organizations like the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. So let's talk about the threats to higher education. This is a protest in my home city around budget cuts to K-12 education. That's actually my son at the microphone. So I'd say we're facing an irreversible change in the public compact, that public higher education used to be a collectively funded public good, and we're now transforming it into an individually purchased private good. Higher education enrollment is down for the first time in 15 years in the U.S., and while people my age and older comprised the third, were third in the world in the percent of having achieved a college education, young people aged 25 to 34 in the U.S. were now 12th in the world. That is a major decline and a major threat to higher education and to global health. Tuition is way up. Half the states have seen double-digit increases. My state has doubled tuition. And state support for education is down. Per student from states is the lowest in 30 years. Soaring student debt, don't need to talk about that. $1 trillion student loan bubble in the United States. The proliferation of for-profit institutions, I think, is a threat to is a threat to higher education, both here and abroad. You notice the major proliferation of private for-profit higher education in poor countries. Some countries are now having 5 and 6 new for-profit medical schools. This can't be a good idea. And we know why these tuitions sell, because people with these degrees can emigrate. US the federal money going to for-profit institutions is now at $32 billion to subsidize loan defaults, which is twice the rate of public schools. And at the same time, there's insufficient capacity to absorb all the students who would like to go to college in the United States. On top of all that, we're seeing the end of tenure, the proliferation of contingent faculty, and increased reliance by many faculty members, especially in the health sciences, on putting together your own funding package through self-employment schemes. So the overlap of these threats, higher education and global health, I think are interactive. The privatization hurts both. The erosion of commitments to and from the public sector hurts both health and education. The widening inequality is bad for everybody. I think with an increased movement towards the for-profit sector and the private sector, there is increased opportunity for corruption, both here and abroad. A robust higher education sector in both poor and rich countries is required to produce a strong health workforce. And undermining both of those undermines a health workforce. And we haven't even mentioned sequestration, the across-the-board budget cuts that are expected to be implemented by Congress unless somebody does something soon. Those are both going to seriously hurt both global health and higher education. So the consequence of all this, this was a protest in front of one of our banks in Seattle, Chase Bank, last fall. Faculty don't have the time, the capacity, or the freedom to pursue relationships with colleagues abroad in any meaningful way. There's a decreased focus on teaching. There is decreased academic freedom to study the important but poorly funded things. And we see an erosion of capacity for civic academic duty activities, such as coming to conferences like this, getting involved in the International Health Section of the American Public Health Association, and peer review. I don't know if anybody's noticing how journals operate their peer review activities, but it's through voluntary donation of time by faculty members. And as faculty members have their time increasingly truncated for activities like that, it is going to hurt the publishing industry. So the way forward, I think it requires all of us to be much more aware of these activities and to engage with the public in protesting the austerity and the cutbacks. This was a protest in my Capitol building last November as the legislature held a special session to cut back education yet again. So I encourage you all to get involved in these issues, both locally and globally, and to see the future of higher education and global health as intertwined.
Great, and thank you to my fellow presenters, because we have moved through very fast, but we've saved enough time so we can have a very spirited discussion. After listening to Amy, I think I'm going to have to dust off my handcuffs. My wife and I were arrested twice in the Nevada test site after an APHA meeting in Las Vegas back in 1987, along with 136 other APHers. So maybe we'll have to dust off the handcuffs, get booked beside a smiling sheriff, and carried off to the detention center that we were at. Okay, open for questions, comments, rants and raves. Go ahead.
Hi, good morning. I'm Simona Dombey from UC Berkeley, and I have a question for Laura. I was aware about the seven main competencies for the MPH. I think they really fit well for like a professional MPH. I was wondering which kind of competency, whether we would need to develop another list for a master, which would be more a master in science, to educate people in research and public health. Mm-hmm. So when do you start doing any work on this area?
Yes. Yeah, you're right. I mean, the competencies right now, as they are for the professional MPH. And we always thought that we're going to start with that. Now, right now, the great discussion is that we already have a lot of competencies in different fields. So we have the MPH, and then we have the preparedness, now the global health, and there are some others. So right now, there's a big discussion, and there's a group working in the training of all the competencies, trying to look at all the competencies that have already been developed, and trying to have like a continuum in order to be more integrated. Because if not, we're going to end up hiring like 10 different sets of competencies that and 1 year of education of our students. So, but yes, we're looking now about the research and the more academic program, how we need also research on global health, and that's more related with the academic program. So we're looking at that right now, but we don't have any competencies so far right now.
Okay, yes.
Thank you to the panel for your work here. Question, I guess, for both Laura and Neil. One of the, you know, the competencies right now focus mostly on public health. Mm-hmm. But most of the folks who go abroad, Neil, as you pointed out, you know, they're medical folks, medical students, medical residents, and so forth. And it's far more sexy to have folks who see the image of a medical doctor going abroad inappropriately delivering a baby, perhaps, in certain situations, and so forth. How do we do a couple things? One, undo that image and reinforce that going abroad with a stethoscope is probably not the best use of your time and money, and might be best as a trainer or as an educator or health promoter. That's one question, and the related question to that is, how do we develop competencies for the medical professions through the AAMC and ACGME that address those points? Because frankly, it's those guys who actually need the competencies more than our public health colleagues.
I guess the premise behind that is that those who go doing other things than clinical things, whether they be education, public health, may be able to do more good than the others, or certainly do less harm. And so I would agree with that. So how do you change things? I actually see a trend in the opposite direction. So not just medical, nursing, rehab students going overseas, but now, probably more than 20 years ago, you find first and second year undergraduate students, 17 or 18 year olds, going in as experts into other countries. They also are doing more, even in inner cities in Canada and the US, and I do think that it's nice to sensitize certain people to issues with service learning types of things. But I think that issues of consent in other countries are quite problematic. So how do you change that? I guess it would involve perhaps the hosts having a voice or being enabled within our context amongst decision makers to have a voice to speak out against that. There are sometimes economic reasons that programs want to have students, even if it isn't so good for communities. I think there has to be a cultural shift amongst students, and I think that's certainly possible. I think that part is beginning in medicine, at least in Canada, and I think even in the US, that people are looking at their impacts. But I think that also will involve leadership. The leadership could include those developing competencies, but it could also involve those in charge of programs, the deans of medicine, saying that we aren't going to support these types of activities in certain places. And it's tough because the programs look good. It's very sexy to have a picture of students in other settings. But I think that it involves leadership and it involves a cultural change.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're right. I think the ASPH has been concentrating just in the public health schools, which are already doing that. But I think one of the challenges right now is just to really relate to other associations in order to have that influence with schools of medicine and others. And I'm going that, Tom, maybe GSEC, because it involves more also the medicine schools that are already doing that. Is that?
Yeah, there have been some developments in this area, and GHEC, we, with a joint Canadian-US committee, we developed competencies for all medical students, irrespective of whether interested in global health. And then we had a bump up for level one, those who might be interested in the Global Health 101 course in a medical school. The nurses are now trying to do the same thing for nursing. This has not been adequately reviewed and vetted and so on, but we feel this is a first step towards getting the AAMC to begin thinking of bringing in some of these standards or competencies into the general medical education guidelines and evaluation of it. That's a long process, and they're kind of hostile to new requirements in there because it's already so loaded. Question in the back, yes.
This is actually kind of a response to this conversation. I think one of the ways that we've been looking at this from the undergraduate area is getting a lot of students to go abroad as undergraduates. And the Forum on Education Abroad, which oversees all of the sending and post programs around the world, has just developed the pre-health standards for students that go abroad, so they do not get involved in things that they shouldn't be doing abroad. But it's a great opportunity for students to start to understand all the issues that really influence public health at an undergraduate level, and we're using the competencies on the programs we're developing around the world. So thank you for the work you've done.
The very first meeting of CUGH, which was at NIH in Bethesda, had five university presidents there, and one of them, University of Maryland, was advocating that all 25,000 University of Maryland students go abroad. Well, you apply that norm to the 300,000 to 400,000 college students, and Lord help Mexico and a lot of other places.
Two questions, really, to answer for any of the panelists. One has to do with the word of use global versus international, and the second is multidisciplinary. I didn't hear anything talk about that. We know the term global means right here locally, certainly here in San Francisco. An example of that, the Philadelphia Thomas Jefferson University in Philadelphia, we have both a refugee health clinic and a clinic for homeless populations right in Philadelphia. Medical students, public health students, nursing students, PTOT students collectively go there and spend time there, multiple languages. What a great global health experience. So that's one question. The other one I want to mention or ask about is multidisciplinary. And I want to use one example. We have, it's been now our seventh year, particularly to Rwanda. It is a multidisciplinary effort. 12 students we had go to Rwanda. Again, medical students, public health, nursing, OT, and pharmacy students. They work together on different projects in teams. And why I mention it is, besides it's student-driven, it's very much student-driven, and it's focused on sustainability, is by working together in a multidisciplinary focus, rather than just medical students, just nursing students, just public health students, it takes these projects have taken on a much broader public health, social consciousness. Great training for the students, but also the nature of the project is quite different than if you just sent medical students. So I'm curious if you could comment on both of those ideas.
Well, I'll just start off really briefly then. So in terms of interprofessional and going beyond interprofessional transdisciplinary, I think that is the way of the future. And the Coughlin paper in The Lancet also refers to that. We have a few of our undergraduate students going in programs to India and Tanzania in those types of teams. So I think other universities are moving in that direction. With regard to local versus global, I have a refugee health clinic in my town, and I used to do mental health in what's called a soup kitchen, although they don't like using the term soup kitchen there. And I do think that those are good learning experiences. However, I think that we're still foisting ourselves on communities. And so we do have to look at where you can get an interchange of information, and there's some students who are actually going to be acting inappropriately in those settings. So I think we have to guard against that. We also have to think about the learning experience, and yes, whether going abroad and sending 25,000 Maryland students overseas versus here, what is the outcome going to be for the student, for the community, and for global health in general?
Yes, just very briefly. Yes, international, the term international relates more to the traditional perspective, meaning international, always keeping your mind, is, you know, is for aid. So global is, for us, is more appropriate just because it involves local and global, and it's the two perspectives. But it's not only that it is about the name, but also the concept. International, it always relates more with cooperation, because it really started as being that, the cooperation. So it's always, again, the health or the missionary approach, rather than the global, which is more, aside of being very inclusive about the local and the international, it also is a different approach, because we are in a global community, we have common programs, we come here as equals to try to develop a common understanding and common solutions. And in the second question, I completely agree. Transdisciplinary, that's the way we have to be really changing all our curricula and our practice in sending or being more related with it among other professions. So.
I wanted to speak to the global education using local interactions. I taught a class a couple years ago, Community Development for Health, and our strategy was to engage our students in a solidarity exercise with a local homeless population. In Seattle, we have several tent city communities, and they are mobile. So they every 3 months, they move to a new location, and they operate under a city agreement to do this. And our students had the idea that we would like to engage our university in hosting a tent city stay. Which was a novel and interesting idea, and we made this a two-quarter class, and students worked on this project. In the end, the university authorities would not agree to this, but they did a wonderful job assembling the data, making a real relationship with the tent city community that that they chose to work with, and developed a great interaction with various entities on campus, all of whom endorsed the idea, even though the administration did not.
Couple of quick comments and then I'll take yours. UCSF tried this and it worked, but it's a challenge. We have four schools, medicine, nursing, dentistry, and pharmacy, and we had a project 3 years with the Fogarty Center, and we sent teams overseas. But the potential participation in pharmacy and dentistry is much less than in nursing and medicine. And the level of interest in global activities is much less in those latter two disciplines. So it was a challenge to make it a realistic one where each of the four participants in the research project overseas, and we had several Africa bases, to make it a realistic training experience. Yes, in the back.
A question on the other side of the exchange of bringing clinicians to the U.S. or Canada. The challenge of getting clinical privileging and credentials for them to actually see patients in the setting here, rather than the assumption is there's no issue with sending American and other clinicians over to these other countries, that of course you can see the patients, but what about the other way around, especially bringing faculty, clinical faculty. Now, students are one thing, we can manage trainees, but it's the faculty, I guess, that I'm concerned. There's other
Does anyone have a
issues with clinical
privileging
in that
study? Brief comment. Yeah, brief comment. So in terms of the students, there still are barriers there in terms of malpractice insurance, financial barriers. But with faculty, last week I was talking to somebody with a program in Mozambique, and they tried to organize a program in Saskatchewan, and Saskatchewan faculty go down to Mozambique and have done so for the last 20 years. But when they tried to have something the other way around, they said, oh no, we can't have you go to see our regular patients. That they were willing to send them up to northern Saskatchewan to deal with Aboriginals, which has ethical things both ways. But you're right, that we don't expect the same things with our programs here in terms of other faculty having the same sort of status when they come here. We think that they're inferior in terms of being able to deal with our patients here, or at least as administration, and something's got to change about that.
an excellent point. I think there are still more barriers here to actually receive people here than to send people. I'm just give you a quick example. And this is in the ASCH Association, as I was telling you. We are, since 7 years ago, the first non-American or non-US-based school which was accredited at ASCH. And we thought, and we feel that we are like equal of the others because we have the standards in order to actually be in the ASCH. But it turns out that every time there are some funds available to actually exchange faculty or students, we cannot apply because we are not American. And then when we said, okay, I mean, we are in the ASCH, those funds are for the ASCH, faculty and students, why we can't? Well, it happens that those funds come from the government. And one of the small letters there says that you have to be a U.S. Citizen or have a green card. Well, it just happened that we don't have that, you know. So far we haven't been able to actually send our faculty or students, even though we are in the ASCH. And this is just an example that there's a lot of barriers here still that we need to, there's a big challenge that we need to really keep on just trying to see how we can do that and not just look at it, you know, the other way around.
Other questions, comments? We've had one, we'll get to you in a moment. In the back, yeah.
Hi, I'm Al Chang from Los Angeles. I wanted to ask Tom, Neil, and Amy, I realize it's a sensitive question, but is there a possible drawback on the potential effect of the so-called brain drain?
Is it possible to reverse the brain drain or stop it?
Well, what's your comment?
Have a fast answer on that?
Oh, very quickly, these joint programs, like I mentioned, Yale's program in Uganda, the University of Toronto in Ethiopia, that with those, you have to make the conditions attractive for the faculty to stay in terms of the exchange of information, in terms of money there. So you have to look at we can think of the push and pull factors. There are a lot of pull factors for bringing skilled people over here, so you have to just make the conditions more attractive for them to stay in the country.
I would agree.
Yeah. Yes.
This question is quite a lot of an address. With respect to the global competency, is there any requirement to be multilingual?
To be?
Multilingual.
no, well, so far they're just, that's a good point. He's talking about the multilingual, and I think that we're talking about global competencies. We need to be aware that we need two other elements in order to be, one is the language, and the other one is the cultural competencies. So I think that it's not just about being able to do all those things, but hopefully most of our students can actually also develop more languages. But I know that that's more of a challenge for you than for other countries in the world. I mean, here it's very unusual to find people that learns or that knows more than one language, but I think that's a challenge. But it's not just the language. It's just the cultural awareness and competency and sensitiveness. So,
yeah, a couple of brief comments picking up on this. I think progress is being made on the brain drain. We're certainly getting more and more sensitive to it, and I think countries are beginning to take a measure of responsibility, but it's obviously a very complicated thing. I've reviewed recently a model, econometric model for Tanzania, on where you have a whole bunch of different incentives and disincentives that you might provide to Tanzanian physicians to keep them from going out of the country and to encourage them to go to rural and disadvantaged areas. And it's still in the process of development, but the idea and hope is that you can then explore alternative scenarios in which you, let's see how much a 10% increase in pay level might affect. Let's see how much you could, decreasing this might affect the movement of physicians. The problem is we don't have the factors very well nailed down as to how much they move things. In my own experience, particularly in Chile, what makes the greatest sense is a package of more than one or two incentives, disincentives. And Chile had five measures that were really quite effective in getting their young physicians to work in rural areas, and then so on. So it's the package that really counts.
Can you comment on what those five factors
are? Yeah, Chile graduated then, this is before Pinochet, graduated 500 positions every year. Well, they could have required a rural internship, which many countries do. You send them out for a year, and then they come back madder in hell because they didn't like the experience, and so on. Instead of sending 500 to 500 different locations, they sent the 500 to basically half as many locations with two doctors in each place. So you had one doctor based at the health center and one doctor able to do mobile clinics in the surrounding posts, which was a great asset, both for the doctors. They had relief, they had a companion to do it. Second is, the term was not 1 year, which many countries have used, it was 3 years. And so you really developed some expertise and some substantial care in the areas. Why would they go? A doctor go for 3 years? If they didn't do this service, they were free to practice in Chile. There was no limitation on it, but they could not get a residency at government expense, and they could never be hired by a government hospital. So thinking ahead, boy, I want to do my 3 years so that I have later access to these a pension, days, sick days, and all the rest of it, as well as the residency. And one other thing that we often forget, all the young doctors were invited to submit at the end of their third year, my experience in Fuchi Fuchi. And so you'd write up a little essay about your experience in Fuchi Fuchi. And then the medical college would review all these things and bring in the top 10 or 15, fly them into Santiago, and they would have a chance to shine before the medical association and get an award. And I think recognizing it's not just sending people out to the periphery and forgetting about them and then assuming that the periphery has now got medical care, that this is a nice package that they had. Certainly, Amy's talk about how we ought to mount the barricades. I was at the Harvard School of Public Health class of 1961. Way back when, and we were worried about the Cold War, and a bunch of us agitated, and we fought the faculty to a draw, finally getting them to accept that we would have in the next year epidemiology of war. And the epidemiology of war is a fascinating subject. It can be looked at just like the epidemiology of smallpox or anything else. They finally relented and agreed, gave us our final exams. It was a one-year program, we all disappeared, and of course the next cohort didn't know anything about it and they never had the course. But it's the sort of thing that might be revived again. Any other comments here? Let me make one last observation then and we can close out. The concern that Illich and others have expressed about what we do overseas. I was a small player in an effort several years back to form a Center for Global Service, led by an emergency doctor at Tufts University, and he had consultant groups all around and Delphi groups, and I, as an executive director of an NGO, was one of participated in a day-long session on it. And the whole idea was to have a voluntary organization that was sort of covers as many of the NGOs as would like to join, but no requirements that they had, and no control over their activities. But through a common mechanism, could develop best practices, could develop robust training programs so that instead of me being a volunteer from my local church and going over with no orientation whatsoever and doing my thing, that you would have educational products and short-term courses and so on to prepare many of the NGO volunteers going over. Would have an evaluation mechanism to get feedback on the various projects, covering the whole wide thing. It's not just health, but in education, development, agriculture, mini banking, microfinance, and so on, to pool the expertise and get that going. Plus, communications so that people could network much more effectively rather than have our individual NGOs functioning like little islands. The project went well. They developed a very fine proposal. It would have cost to get it launched about $1.7 million. They were not able to do it, what with the collapse and everything, so I think the idea is dead. But maybe someday that will revive to help modulate the cacophony that we now have in do-gooders of all stripes trying to run around the world and help things. Well, thank you very much. Did you have
yes, please.
One? Go ahead.
Yep.
We do have a couple minutes here.
Hi, folks. Omar Khan, I'm Program Chair for International Health.
Yes.
I wanted to thank Tom for helping organize not just this session, but the next two as well, along with myself. This is a sort of a mini CUGH GHEC series of panels within APHA. We have Global Health Education 1, 2, and 3. Number 2, the next panel is coming up, chaired by my colleague, Dr. Rob Simmons, whom you heard from, and that's going to be in Pacific B. Global Health 3, which is focusing on global health in medical education specifically, chaired by myself, is going to be in Pacific C. So it's 10:30 to 12 and then 12:30 to 2. So stick around for all of that. But really, I want to thank the distinguished panel for taking the time to come here today. So thank you, folks, very much.
Thank you.